Welcome to Living Healthy Together. Each week we share patient stories, advice and insights from those closest to care, dive into health-related current events, and explore the local and national issues shaping healthcare across our region. I'm your host, Philip Rao, with University of Vermont Health.
Most outgoing, loving, caring, funny, goofy, crazy cat lady possible. Getting to see her thrive for the last 8 years after being told countless times we don't know what the outcome is going to be and all the hospitalizations of every illness, saying we don't know if her heart's going to take it, we don't know if her lungs can take it, to watch her just thrive and get through every single one of them to make it to today and still be doing amazing.
Alexa Value has been through more medical procedures and spent more time in hospitals, clinics, and phlebotomy offices in her 8 years than most people do in a lifetime. Alexa's medical journey began before she was even born, with an anatomy scan revealing a heart murmur and ultimately leading doctors to discover other heart and lung-related problems and diagnose her with DeGeorge syndrome, a genetic disorder that affects the body's development and can lead to a range of medical issues, from congenital heart defects and developmental delays to immune system problems. Alexa went through her first heart procedure less than 24 hours after being born, and her first open heart surgery when she was less than a month old. In the 8 years since, she's had 4 more open heart surgeries, along with 17 other heart procedures, 2 major arterial surgeries, emergency brain surgery, and more. Not to mention countless needle pokes from blood draws and other diagnostic procedures. Those procedures and their long-term emotional and psychological impact brought Alexa and her mother Brittany to the Comfort Zone, a pre-procedural space at Golisano Children's Hospital designed to help children navigate medical care with less fear and more personalized support. Launched nearly 2 decades ago, the Comfort Zone's team of pediatric nurses and a child life specialist pioneers a trauma-informed approach to care that prioritizes trust and uses science-based, age-appropriate education and coping strategies to support the emotional, developmental, and cultural needs of children and families. Today on Living Healthy Together, we'll hear from Brittany about Alexa's medical journey and her experience as a mother and medical advocate, and speak with some of the nurses, specialists, and physicians who have dedicated their careers to helping the most vulnerable patients avoid traumatic experiences that can impact their willingness to get care later in life. Brittany, thanks for being with us today. At just 8 years old, Alexa's medical journey is already bigger and more complex than most. Take us back to the very beginning.
When I was pregnant with her, before her anatomy scan, her father had a small heart condition and needed surgery when he was around, I think, 3 or 6 months old. So when they did her anatomy scan, I asked them to pay close attention to her heart. And that's when they found a heart murmur. I was at Northwestern Medical Center up in St. Albans for their OBGYN. But then they transferred me to UVM because of the high risk. And from there, they did a fetal echo and they found that she had a hole between her ventricles. And they basically told me that my entire birthing plan was going out the window. I would have to be induced, have her delivered at Brigham and Women's, then transferred over to Children's Hospital. But before that entire plan got set in place, we got sent down to figure out the scope of her heart condition. And from there, we got her actual diagnosis of tetralogia fallot with pulmonary atresia, ventricle septal defect, and then MAPKIS, which are basically, instead of the normal branches to your lungs, hers kind of grew along both of her lungs, kind of treating them oxygen in different areas instead of altogether. Once she was born, we spent the first 3.5 months in the hospital. So kind of started before she even came out.
Many people have complex pregnancies. And certainly if you're a first-time parent, there's likely a healthy dose of anxiety and maybe even some fear that's a part of things. But this is an experience that's completely unrecognizable to many, if not most folks. How do you explain what it's like going through all of that?
It was an absolute roller coaster from the beginning. When we first found out she was going to need open heart surgery at some point, I was actually by myself during her fetal echo. So
it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks, and I didn't really know how to react. So I think I spent a good hour in the parking garage at UVM trying to just piece together what I just heard. And then from there, everything was kind of scary for the last 5 months of my pregnancy. And then we had to do an amnio to find out that she actually has a syndrome called DeGeorge syndrome, which is the reason she has her heart defect and all of her other issues that she's had growing up between learning disabilities, being nonverbal, and having developmental delays. But for the first 3.5 months when she was in the hospital, when everything started, I really didn't know what to do. I kind of just stayed in her hospital room. Like, I really didn't venture out. She had her first procedure when she was less than 24 hours old. She had a heart catheterization, which then led to complications of her femoral artery kind of clotting off in her left leg. And we had to start giving her Lovenox injections. And she stayed on those for almost 2.5 years. During those 3 months, she had 5 heart catheterizations, 1 planned open heart surgery to put in a right ventricle to her pulmonary artery conduit just to make sure that everything was getting the supply that was needed. And then her second open heart surgery was an emergent one because after one of her heart catheterizations, they had to go in and balloon dilate her pulmonary arteries to help them stay open so more supplies could get through. At that age, you can really only use one size balloon. And at that point, they overstretched one of them. And with her high blood pressure, it created a pseudoaneurysm that ended up blocking the blood flow to her left coronary artery, which basically, if they didn't catch it in time or it ruptured, I would have lost her.
That's a lot.
Oh, yes. Especially being mom for the first time. It was definitely rough, but having them tell me at that point that she was probably going to have failure to thrive, she was having feeding issues and aspirating. So for the first couple months she was there, she had an NG tube for a feeding tube that went down her nose. But from there, we had to look at kind of the bigger picture. So they ended up putting in a G tube, which has done fantastic. And at first, I hated it in every way. But now that thing is my saving grace, and I would be lost without her having it. But since all of those, she's altogether had 19 heart catheterizations, 4 open heart surgeries. And then in 2020, I brought her into the ED because she was feeling off. She got diagnosed with flu B or flu A. Forgot which one it was. So we went home, did the normal like Tamiflu, kind of kept her regulated through that. But things got really bad. So I brought her back into the hospital to have her admitted so the nurses could keep an eye on her because she was getting to the point where it was too uncomfortable for me to keep her home. And then 2 or 3 days later, she ended up being rushed down to the PICU and emergently intubated, had a head CT, and we found out that she actually had a brain bleed, and then was airlifted to Boston, and that one bleed turned into 3 more, so she had a total of 4, and then during those, she had 2 strokes and multiple seizures, and this was all happening during COVID, right when it broke out. So the hospitals were an absolute mess. She had to have an emergent craniotomy. She had to learn how to walk again. She still has left side weaknesses. She has to be on a seizure med just as a precaution to make sure everything kind of stays at bay, because she'll still kind of have like focal seizures where she kind of
stares off and or have like lip twitches. So it's definitely, it's been a very, very wild roller coaster for her only being 8 years old.
You're a mom, you're a medical advocate, you're managing the workings of a whole family. What's that been like for you?
It's been extremely stressful beyond belief, trying to keep up with medications, therapies, school at the same time, make sure that my stepkiddos get what they need and make sure that it's not just all about her, because as much as like they understand it as well, I don't want them to feel like just because she's sick or has an illness that she kind of comes before everything. So, but between that, cooking, cleaning, doing everything, tried going back to work at one point, and that lasted for a short bit just for the amount of times that the school was calling because she needed to come home due to illness or kind of just doctor's appointments and everything. So that basically kind of took over that. So definitely been a huge game changer from what I was able to do before to now, but I wouldn't change it for the world. I've definitely had to come up with things to kind of de-stress myself for getting back into like reading to kind of have like my own time, or like when she goes to her father's for the weekend, trying to do as much as I can to get out of the house, because it's kind of complicated with her being on oxygen 24/7 and then depending on the weather, temperatures, and how she's doing, we can't really go out and about too much, which is a bummer because she's my social little butterfly. But it's definitely been an adjustment, and even after 8 years, I'm still fine-tuning everything to find the perfect balance of not going insane.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Brittany and learn how she and Alexa found themselves in a place at Golisano Children's Hospital called the Comfort Zone. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're diving into how pediatric patients with complex medical needs experience healthcare and how a dedicated team of healthcare professionals at Golisano Children's Hospital is helping them and their families avoid traumatic experiences, which can impact their willingness to get care later in life. Brittany, when we went to break, you were talking about the procedures and medical crises that dominated your lives for years, but we haven't yet made it to the comfort zone. When did you and Alexa first find yourselves there, and why?
The first time we found ourselves in the comfort zone was Alexa when she was getting her blood drawn, because after 2020, she became an extremely difficult sick to try to get labs or anything from her. And anytime we went to the normal phlebotomy, she was uncomfortable, I was uncomfortable, and it was just really, really rough because it'd be like multiple pokes in this tiny little room. And then one day, I think it was her social worker, Leah, who was just like, hey, we just got this. It's based around kids to make them feel more like at ease. And I was like, ooh, like that would be awesome. And the thing I liked the most about it, the girls who were working in there were the girls who have taken care of Alexa since she first got transferred from Boston to UVM as nurses on Baird 5. They were all familiar faces, so it wasn't like we were going somewhere where we didn't know anyone or Alexa didn't know who she was going to be around. It was absolutely amazing to go there, and she already had the connection with them. That definitely made that kind of shift a lot better and just more comfortable, because it's more kid-friendly instead of just three walls and a sliding glass door and kind of just people in, out, and orders being yelled back and forth. And now anytime we have to go for current lab work, she loves it. She gets excited. She's through the door, goes straight to the toys, knows where Jess is, just all of it. She's ready to go. Everyone there is absolutely amazing because most of the kids that are going in, they've taken care of them before. And even if they haven't, they make it seem like it's not the first time. They're so loving, caring, and anything you say, my child doesn't like this, or we do this this way, they work with you and make sure that your kiddo gets exactly what is needed. If it's toys, having an iPad to play with, if it's cars, drawing, anything, they make sure that it's there. And if you have a poke plan, they make sure they stick to that. One of the times when we went for something that wasn't labs and Alexa needed a pre-med for it, they made sure she was comfortable, that if she asked them to come and sit for a minute and stay with her because like she was kind of off, just jittery about it, they'd come sit, talk to her, and they made her feel more comfortable before and after the procedure.
Just doing the math in my head, Alexa would have been about 3 when you first went to the comfort zone. And you also talked about the shift you saw in her and how she experiences being in a healthcare setting because of the comfort zone. Did that change happen gradually or all at once?
Normally, Alexa, when it comes to anything medically, she's pumped, even if she doesn't feel good and she knows we're going to the ER and she knows her favorite ER doctor is normally working. She's pumped. But most of the time with going into phlebotomy, because you don't always have the same person every time, and it's just whoever gets your orders and goes. So when we went from phlebotomy into that, it was like instant, let's go. And now anytime when I'm like, oh, we have labs to go do, she'll kind of be like, no, no. And I'll be like, oh, hey, we have to go get labs and go see Jess and all the girls. And she's like, let's go. She's good. And she'll ask about it all the time when she knows it's coming up. And she's just pumped. We actually just recently went and saw them on the 2nd, and we just got their card that they send out after every kiddo goes in for anything with them. They send a you did great card. So we have multiple of them throughout the house saying you're a rock star, and all of them sign it and put little drawings. They're fantastic.
Does it surprise you that Alexa is able to display such resilience and even find joy given how many challenges she has faced? This is an 8-year-old who has picked out her favorite ER doctor to see. That's an incredible display of adaptability.
To me, it's absolutely amazing because there are still parts in the hospital for rooms that she's had. I don't even want to walk by. I don't want to see. I want no part of it because of the memories that they hold. And her, she can go into the pre-cath lab waiting area and she'll run around the hall. She'll say hi to the doctor. Even when it's time to go back, knowing that she's going to be put to sleep and go under, because she understands like the basic concept of what's going to happen, she's still excited. Most of the time, she won't get her pre-med right away and they'll just wheel her right back. So to me, it's absolutely amazing. And I'm still completely shocked of how okay she is with everything. And I'm beyond grateful that she is so resilient with it and that it doesn't bug her as much, or she's not as kind of shaken up by it, because I feel like that would just make everything 10 times harder than what it already is, having to go in and have so many little traumatic things happen and then bounce back so quickly.
You mentioned some of the folks at the Comfort Zone who care for Alexa, and we're lucky to have a few of them with us today, including Jennifer Eddy, the child life specialist who serves as part of the Comfort Zone care team. Jennifer, thanks for joining us. Let's start with a little bit about your role on the team. What is a child life specialist and what do you do?
Child life specialists are trained professionals who help children cope with the stress and uncertainty of illness and injury, disability, and hospitalization. We're child development experts, and we try to promote effective coping through play, self-expression, and age-appropriate preparation and education. We work alongside the medical team, and we try really hard to meet emotional, developmental, and cultural needs of children and families.
I think almost every parent is familiar with the experience of being in a healthcare setting with their child, but it's so easy to get tied up in your own emotions, whether that's anxiety or impatience or worry. What do kids experience? How does being in a hospital or a healthcare setting impact them?
It's very important for us to meet patient and family needs. When we walk in the door, we address both the patients and the families. We can see the stress on the parents' faces. And so we really try to help calm families as well as kids by talking to them about what they can expect from the day, what the steps are, what we can do to support them emotionally, physically, and do everything we can to make it a positive experience for patients and families. Whether it's getting the children toys or getting the parent a glass of water, we really try to support families in any way that they seem to need the support.
Do you remember your first experience with the comfort zone? How did you end up as part of that care team?
I've worked in pediatric healthcare for almost 20 years, and I started off as a teacher and decided that I loved teaching, but not in the formal classroom setting. So I went back to career services at UVM, and they told me all about Child Life. And I started volunteering at the hospital and found that I absolutely loved it, did an internship, and I've been here since. I ended up helping out a coworker by filling in the comfort zone and ended up falling in love with it. And I've been here since. I really cherish being able to see kids come in, support them through a procedure, and then help them get back home. Occasionally, we have kids who are admitted after their procedures, but I like being able to support kids full circle.
We just heard a lot about Alexa's medical journey and how the comfort zone made an impact for her. Who is the comfort zone intended to support? Is there a specific group of patients you work with?
The comfort zone is a pediatric sedation area. We support kids and families who are having perhaps radiology procedures. So we place a lot of IVs and provide education about the procedure that the child might be having, and then support them through the process of the procedure, and then potentially recover them. We also work with a group of individuals who have needle phobia and anxiety about coming to get blood drawn. So we support those kids oftentimes in the afternoons after our radiology procedures are complete. And those children need a lot of time and patience. Every plan is very different. We try to meet kids where they are and develop plans alongside kids and families to meet their specific needs. A lot of those kids, again, have needle phobia or happen to be neurodivergent and have needle phobia.
For folks who may not know, what is needle phobia and how does it occur? Does it just naturally happen? Some people have it, some don't. Or are there common experiences people have before developing it?
It's our job to explain the process if the parents and the child are open to it and support them, make a plan and support them through it, and they can be successful. Sometimes they need a little medication to get through that process because they might be scared and our regular offerings may not be enough. Some kids come in and they have had needle experiences in other hospitals or other parts of the hospitals, and perhaps they haven't gone well and have some trauma. And so we start from scratch and we find out what it is they are very anxious about and try to figure out a way to get them through the process, whether it's by re-educating or developing some coping strategies or just recreating a different plan that might work better for them. So desensitization visits are visits that kids come in, learn about the process, they meet our team, they see our space, we go over each step very carefully again and again until they're confident about each step, until we get to the point where they can sit with their arm out and allow a nurse to simulate the process. Sometimes kids need more than one desensitization visit before they come, and sometimes kids need one the day before every blood draw that they come to until they build their confidence. I facilitate these desensitization visits and include the nursing in the process so that the kids can get to know the nursing staff and they're familiar with them before the actual blood draws. Another word for desensitization visit is exposure therapy. So that might be more familiar to folks out there. We have a psychologist, Rebecca Ruid, that also facilitates desensitization visits with kids and families. So we work together as a team to come up with ways to support kids when they are very fearful of needle pokes.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Jennifer and welcome two of the pediatric nurses who are also members of the Comfort Zone Care team to discuss how trauma-informed care is changing the way young people experience medical procedures and why that's important for their health, not just in the present, but throughout the rest of their lives. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're diving into the comfort zone at Golisano Children's Hospital and discussing the impact trauma-informed care and support makes on children and families as they navigate complex medical journeys and procedures. We're talking with Jennifer Eddy, a child life specialist, and now welcome two pediatric nurses who also serve as members of the Comfort Zone care team, Patty Haidar and Jess Potvane. Thanks for joining us. You're both veterans of pediatric nursing. What drew you not just to pediatrics, but this very specific part of that work?
Working with kids, you just see a different level of resilience and how quickly they can cope with a certain ailment and recover from it, thrown with different obstacles that as we get older and into our adult life, we might notice that we aren't actually even as equipped as some of these young children to overcome obstacles. I think there's the piece of the medical component for pediatric care. And then I think the subpart is the psychosocial component of working with these children and knowing not only how to care for them with their disease process or whatever is going on medically, but how to take care of them and meet their basic needs, how you approach them, how you talk to them, how you give them time to process. There's just so much to that piece, that component of the nursing that is in our minds equally as important.
Agreed. I have always wanted to work in pediatrics. I've always been drawn to kids. Like Jess said, there's a resilience there. They bounce back. They're not jaded like adults. We know what to expect. We know what's going to happen. We've been through this life. This is their first go. And sometimes they don't know what the worst case scenario is. Adults do. The parents do. I love working with the kids and getting to know them outside of their illness because this is just a part of them. It's not who they are. And so for me, getting a kid to laugh or giving them the tools to know that they can be brave instead of fearful, that's really helpful for me to do my profession.
The Comfort Zone has been around for quite some time now, about 17 years, if I'm not mistaken, but your team continues to do new things. Let's talk a little bit about this pilot program you've been running for the past year. What's that work focused on?
Jess and I have started a pilot program for ages 18 to 26 for young adults who have complex care needs and
learning differences that might just benefit from a different approach than traditional medical approaches.
You know, we think when you turn 18, you're automatically an adult and you can transition right into adult care services. But for a lot of kids that grow into young adults with complex care needs who've been part of the medical system their entire lives, it is not easy to transition, especially if they have cognitive or developmental delays or differences.
So we work with kids up until age 18, and our approach is applicable to children with neurodiversity or learning differences, but it's also applicable to neurotypical children. And you can have a neurotypical child who has a bad experience in healthcare setting, and they might carry that experience with them throughout their life. So it's even, we really, our approach is applicable to everyone in the population, and we just tailor it to the specific needs.
What was the impetus there? Why is it important to expand these supportive services to young adults?
Frankly, there's a gap in care. There's a gap in services for people who need extra support. We get phone calls all the time from distraught caregivers and parents who are like, my 25-year-old really needs their labs drawn and I can't take them to the lab, but they're not really 25. They act like they're 5. Why can't we come through you? And we had to have a hard stop because if we opened our doors, we wouldn't be able to provide the base service that we're here for. So Jess and I got to talking and we decided that we have time in the afternoons and it would be really beneficial to start this program to show that it is definitely a necessity in our community.
If you think about it, if a young adult is not going to get their basic healthcare needs, such as monitoring labs for whatever medication they're on, and then there's a lot of preventative medical care that is really important, screening, colonoscopies as you get older, mammograms, and there's just a lot of preventative care that you have. If you have a healthcare system that does not tailor its approach to all these individual needs, you might have individuals that will just not get that care.
Yeah, and they just fall through the cracks.
They fall through the cracks, and then later in life, there might be something that comes up that could have been caught. That's that gap in care that we're trying to focus on.
As medicine improves, I mean, we all know this, the research is out there. As medicine improves, lives, people who weren't expected to live a longer life are living longer and longer. And yet, I've been out of nursing school quite some time, but I don't think it's changed. No one teaches you how to deal with and approach patients with different needs, different cognitive abilities.
And I think the healthcare system in general is fast paced. You have a lot of patients that are coming in. You have a schedule you need to adhere to. Sometimes you're just not given the time that is needed to care for these individuals. And we find that is the biggest thing that we do in general is we provide. And sometimes that's what is needed. You just have to pause and take a slower approach, put a little bit more time in the beginning of whatever you're doing. And then sometimes we see that the procedure, whatever medical care you're hoping to perform, goes smoother and quicker. But a lot of departments are just not set up that way. And it's not to the nurse's fault or
anything. No one's fault.
Yeah, it's lots of demand. Got to get these people in, got to get them out. And that's not for everyone.
It sounds like a very much needed project. What's been the response so far from patients, caregivers, and families? And what's your experience been as the folks working in the pilot?
The parents are often grateful. The young adults are often pleased that they got this done. They knew how hard it was for them and they got it done. I think the biggest challenge that we have is engagement. So we are very seated into the pediatric realm. And so we've been able to capture those patients who haven't quite left pediatric care yet, but the patients that we haven't been able to reach are the ones that are already in adult services. It's been very well received by getting the word out there and getting engagement from patients and caregivers has been the challenge.
We know there's a need. We're just trying to reach those individuals that are in need.
Jennifer, what's it been like to see young people who you worked with in the comfort zone come back and continue to receive that support even after they become young adults?
It means a great deal to be able to say yes to adult families who have been working in the comfort zone for many years. And for those who haven't had the opportunity to have blood drawn many times as a pediatric patient because of the struggles that they have had with kids with needle phobia. Families who have developed relationships with us are really thankful to be able to continue care. Continuity of care is really important for kids, especially kids who are neurodivergent.
I think a big piece of what you're talking about here is trust. And no matter how good your documentation is, you can't just hand over trust to someone new. That's not the way it works.
Yes, families trust us with their children. They trust us to help make good choices so that they will have minimal fear and anxiety moving forward. So they trust us to make good plans based on the kids' needs. Things like developmental delays, assistive technology that they might use, past experiences, things like that help with the environment. Do they need low lighting? Do they have sensitivities to temperature? Or Do they need toys to help them regulate their bodies? We focus on approaches like meeting kids at eye level with a calm demeanor, minimizing touch when possible, using phrases like first, then. We focus on communication styles based on verbal abilities, and word choices really matter. We try to use positive language, feel free of blame, and we use visual schedules and social stories, things that can help people really understand what's happening if they learn a little bit differently. And we help kids with regulating their body when they are really stressed. And we work on building coping strategies to help do that. And we make plan A's, B's, and C's because we know that one day a child might benefit from one plan, and then the next they may need a totally different plan. So we really talk with kids and families about what they need in that day, in that moment.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation about the comfort zone at Golisano Children's Hospital from the perspective of a pediatrician whose passion for working with pediatric patients with complex needs led her to take a leading role in the education of generations of pediatricians in training. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're diving into the impact of the comfort zone at Golisano Children's Hospital, a pre-procedural space focused on providing individualized support to pediatric patients, and now also some young adults with complex care needs. We're joined now by Dr. Jill Reinhardt, a primary care pediatrician at the Children's Hospital, vice chair of culture and belonging, and the program director of the pediatric residency program. Dr. Reinhardt, thanks for joining us. Let's start with what drives you to wear all of these hats and do this work. Because in addition to those roles I just mentioned, you also have a special interest in working with pediatric patients who have complex needs.
I grew up with a younger brother and a sister who both had a genetic condition that was progressive. So they had medical complexity. And so I knew from a young age that I had a lot of respect and mentorship from pediatrics, actually. And so I went to medical school. I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota, came east to Dartmouth for college, was eager to get home to my family and siblings. So I did medical school at the University of Minnesota. And then, as Dr. First says, saw the light of the Green Mountains and was delighted to match here for my pediatric residency around the turn of the century and have been here ever since. I graduated from this program and then joined primary care practice with Dr. Joe Hagen, who was a solo practitioner at the time. Over the next 20 years, we grew that practice. And in 2019, about 20 years into my career, realized I had a passion for advocacy and teaching. I'm the director for the residency program. I still see patients. I tend to see kids with more medical complexity and have had a passion for kids with neurodivergence, including intellectual disability and autism, and have done some work with our community in trying to up the game of primary care for addressing these populations who have specific health disparities and risks and need a certain gentle approach, which led me to the work with the comfort zone.
How does medical complexity change the way a very young person experiences the world and interacts with the healthcare system?
In many ways, it's the same as any other kid. I think what we are able to do as a medical home and a pediatric practice is to help children and families with medical complexity to thrive in other scenarios. So it's our job to help bring that medical diagnosis to school and make sure that they have access to their education and community and peers. I think in primary care, we really recognize that kids are 99% of the time, hopefully, out in the community and not in the medical neighborhood and the children's hospital, et cetera. But it does come with its own set of challenges. Kids with neurodivergence have a different thinking pattern. They may need communication support. They may have different motor development, may not be able to access their school buildings, their activities in a manner that is there for neurotypical kids. And then there's chronic illness too. So kids with medical complexity may have asthma. They may have a tendency to have feeding difficulties. And we want to make sure that none of that gets in the way of them thriving in the community.
I'm glad you gave a couple examples. You hear medical complexity as a layperson and you think, oh, someone with an exceptional medical journey or a unique experience. And it doesn't have to be that. It can be any kind of chronic condition that adds complexity.
Yeah, you know, it's probably worth defining that a little bit more. We talk about children with special health care needs. We have a survey every 2 years, and that can be upwards of 20% if you include a special need like asthma. So pretty much anything that requires a child to be on a daily medication is considered a medical complexity or a child with special health care need. And then there's lots of pockets. I think of sort of the top 2 to 3% of kids with special health care needs are these more medically complex kids who often have more than one body system involved. So they may need breathing support. They may need feeding support. They may have neurological concerns like seizures or hearing loss or have communication differences. So that truly medically complex are sort of the top of that pyramid of kids with special health care needs in general, all of whom we want to work with as a pediatric medical home.
You've been involved with the Comfort Zone for many years. How has the program grown and developed through its nearly two decades?
It was originally conceived specifically really for painful procedures, and our nephrologist, Dan Gio, is also a program director, really helped provide a space where kids could go and have a procedure with sedation or anesthesia and child life, which is really behavioral support for kids undergoing painful procedures, and even things like blood draws and things that are more invasive to kids who are young. So having an MRI where you have to be completely still, a three-year-old can't do that without some sedation and support. And the whole purpose of the Comfort Zone is to limit medical trauma. Kids who are repeatedly sort of held down, forced to have lab draws or other painful procedures, the body remembers that. And it won't get easier as they get older. If they have a negative experience once, then the next negative experience will build on that. So our job is really to prevent young people from turning into adults who are fearful of medical procedures and who have significant anxiety around that. I had some personal experiences with older patients that have intellectual disabilities, and you need to have a developmental approach with them. Even an 18-year-old who has a cognitive ability of a 7-year-old, you can't just go up to them and say, hey, we're going to do this test right now. You have to have a gentle approach, and the Comfort Zone allows for that, using play as a way to engage in the process. So really two goals. One, to provide children with positive and pain-free experiences with medical procedures. And two, to help desensitize those kids who have had negative experiences, to try to help them gain the skills back to feel like they can go through with a painful procedure and really help set up their future in a way so when they're fully adult, they don't necessarily need the Comfort Zone anymore.
We know through research or anecdotal observation how quickly things can go off track for young or exposed to traumatic medical experience.
Every child has a different level of resilience, and so there's not sort of a specific number of painful procedures that kind of sets you up for failure. But there is an approach that we recommend for all kids. We now have something called POC plans in our primary care settings, even so that families and their child have a plan ahead of time. Would you like to sit on your mom's lap for this immunization? Would you like to have a numbing cream placed on your arm before you receive an injection? And that helps when kids are engaged in the process and know that we're trying to help this go as easily for them as possible. It reduces everyone's anxiety in the room and helps the procedure to get better. So I guess my hope is that everyone from day one starts off with a plan for undergoing painful procedures, from immunizations in the primary care practice to more invasive studies like VCUGs and things that happen in the comfort zone. And then if we do have a child who has had negative experiences and is really resistant, that we have a safe space for them to become desensitized. And we've had several cases of success there, you know, kids, 12, 13 year olds who often with autism, but not always, who may just need to get through the door of the hospital on their first day. And that's a success. And then maybe get all the way to the comfort zone and sit in the chair and meet a nurse. And that's a second success. And then often by the fourth or fifth visit, understanding what needs to be done and having the right support, the child will be able to undergo that procedure. And then we have a recipe for how to address that with them in the future. And so now I've had graduates of the desensitization who now just go to the regular lab. Sometimes they need bubbles or a specific song that they listen to, but it really requires small steps and comfort growth over time to kind of help desensitize a child to a painful procedure.
It seems like something that is probably now baked in at the very foundational level of clinical training and pediatric residencies. When did that movement begin? How has it progressed? And what are you excited about for the future?
When I was a resident, we were just recognizing, so at the very beginning, 25 years ago, people thought that children experienced pain, infants experienced pain in a different way than adults. So there was really very little thought to numbing a child before doing a painful procedure. Things like circumcisions were done without anesthetic way back. And we now know, and I'm very excited that very quickly in the last 20 years, we've learned, obviously, these are little humans. They experience pain and their body remembers those episodes of pain. I would say the last 10 years have been really critical for understanding how to help kids through painful procedures. We have pediatric pain services in most children's hospitals and things like the comfort zone as well.
As a clinical trainer and someone that's directing a residency program now, what is your current focus? Is there a current challenge or a current hurdle that emerging clinicians need to get through?
I have a specific interest in working with youth with intellectual disabilities and autism, because I do think there are very teachable skills that clinicians need to know to meet the needs of these young people. And we're not really trained specifically during medical school for addressing those populations. Even just recently, we have the annual Health Equity Summit. And 2 years in a row now, I've been able to talk to emerging physicians about what they really need as an approach to having adequate medical care, so a relationship with their doctor. If you're not a pediatrician who's used to working with kids all across the developmental spectrum, what our youth tell us is that they like to be addressed specifically. Sometimes these young adults with intellectual disabilities and autism will have an adult with them or a caregiver with them, but that doesn't mean they don't want to be talked directly to by their physician. So talk to me, talk directly to the patient is very helpful. Using plain language, which means not medical jargon. And then often we do a teach back method. So then I can see, are they understanding the teaching that we're providing so that they can get their medicine adequately? And then third is recognizing that often kids with intellectual disabilities, developmental differences, have a different pain threshold. Often parents of kids with autism will say, something is wrong with my kid and they're not communicative, but they never, you know, sleep late in the morning. Something must be wrong. So often I think parents get really worried about missing something that's going on with their child if they're not communicating with speech or in a typical fashion. And so clinicians recognize that pain, illness may be a different experience for a child or youth with intellectual or developmental disability. So we teach about that. And then finally, another area where clinicians are sort of learning and expanding their ability to care for this population is something we call diagnostic overshadowing. Often physicians sort of assume that the concern that may or may not be medical is related to their overarching diagnosis of intellectual disability or autism, and so they might miss something that is truly medical going on. So what we try to do with this population is really rule out anything medical first before assuming that it's behavioral, unless it's a clearly like brand new situation. It clearly started with that new situation. So that was a long response to things that I'm excited for clinicians to know about working with this population of children. And there are a large number of young people, I often say sort of a tsunami of young people with disabilities who are growing into adulthood. And that's a wonderful thing. We have medical advances that have enabled kids to live a lot longer and with different disabilities to thrive where they may not have before. But it does put the onus on our internal medicine docs, family medicine docs, to both provide the space for this population within their practices, but also to gain the skills for working with this population specifically. That's often a challenge right now.
That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thanks to all our guests for being with us and sharing their stories and insights. If you're out there listening and have a question, comment, or idea for a future episode, email us at healthtalk@uvmhealth.org. Living Healthy Together is also available as a podcast. If you're interested in checking out some of our past episodes, look us up wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow, subscribe, and consider giving us that 5-star rating, which really helps a lot. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.